the devil awakens.
Maximus wrests his life from the underworld.
Hey boy, what in the world are you doing here?
He was elated with his escape.
I wanted out.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.
Thank you all for coming. And I'm going to read I Never Speak Without My Paper. Is that okay, Henry? No. If you make a giant step, like Maximus, heading eastward against the current of the migration of Western civilization, if you cross all the way beyond the Atlantic to the eastern shores of the Mediterranean and tread on the coast of a little south of Tyre, where once stood the ancient polis that Olson conceived as a kind of twin city of Gloucester, if you take that huge step, beware, there, far away from the New World and from the beautiful island of Cape Ann, lies the tiny state of Israel, and so tiny it is that Maximus' foot could crush it. Unlike the myth, no milk, no honey await you there, but a small militaristic state where, between rockets and bombs, some crazy birds, poets we call them, break free and migrate with the imaginary wings of words. Among them, believe it or not, are a few who heard of this beautiful fishing town while tracing the path of a fellow bird. Indeed, these human birds won't conform to national borders. They'd rather see themselves as part of one multifaceted flock. Although Charles Olson didn't make it to the Holy Land, his poetic shadow, Maximus, did. And it is my wish to present to you tonight, albeit briefly, these few poets who read Olson's poems and were influenced by his poetry. First among them is Harold Schimmel. Harold Schimmel is a fascinating Hebrew poet whose work has not yet received the appropriate critical attention in Hebrew or in English. He is what you might call a poet's poet, highly regarded among senior poets, but being what you might call a difficult poet, he is not easily interpreted and his Hebrew is compact and somewhat unusual. He has not yet reached a larger audience. Schimmel was born in 1935 in the US, grew up in New York, and immigrated to Israel in 1962. Upon arrival in Israel, Schimmel's Hebrew was the Hebrew of the synagogue and Sunday school. His competence in the language came from self-learning while in Israel. He started writing poetry in English back in the US and hung out with the poets and artists of the 50s and the 60s in New York and Boston. He was especially close to Robert Lowell, for whom he dedicated a whole book of poems in Hebrew, on which I will elaborate on in a moment. Only in Hebrew, and only after immigrating to Israel, did Schimmel find his own voice as a poet. This highly original poet has published 10 books of poetry. 2 books of selected poetry were published in English in superb translation by Peter Cole. These two. They're not pink. From Island to Island and Katsida. And From Island to Island is basically a selected. Olson's influence on Schimmel is evident first and foremost in Schimmel's choice of writing long poems. Indeed, Olson was not the only poet to influence Schimmel in this regard. It was the influence of the American tradition of the long poem, especially poets like Pound and Williams. In an interview, Schimmel says, "The very idea of a long poem attracted me, a poem that is beyond the average literary supplement poem, which even when it is a good poem, it is always limited and can never be bigger than the page. If one is nourished by poetry, it is like taking a vitamin, but it has not the breadth you find in American poetry. I was enchanted by long poems. Someone like Pound, walking and rewriting and gets stuck and starts again because things accumulate and enrich the poem. The poem keeps rolling. Of course, the original is in Hebrew. It's my translation. Okay. I will now shortly present three early books by Schimmel that merge to one long poem, a growing autonomous body of work, somewhat similar to Olson's Maximus. This long poem was written over a period of 15 years and follows Schimmel's first years in Israel. In other words, the framework of the poem, as in Olson's work, is the place that the poet chooses for his home, a place that he reconstructs in the poem. The long poem is called Ara, and in Hebrew, Ara, meaning land, but in today's Hebrew we use Eretz for land, those two different words. Ara is Aramaic, and when in use nowadays, it brings to mind the chosen land, such as in the Jewish tradition. The long poem Ara tells the story of the place and the poet's physical and spiritual connection to the place while reconstructing the place, like Olson does with Gloucester in the Maximus. In both cases, it is an ongoing process of poetic reconstruction that gives the poet a place in the surrounding world. The first book in the long poem Ara is called Ara 1-8. That's the first one. And indeed consists of eight parts. These eight parts portray different places in Israel, Tel Aviv, Akka, Achziv, cities, kibbutzim, all kinds of places. These places are tied to Schimmel's biography, but the emphasis on the land and the surroundings turns the mere biographical details to a comprehensive historic and cultural view. Like in the Maximus, space is the means with which the limited biography becomes a part of the collective historic and cultural frame. Within his poem, the poet makes himself the native son of the land. The second book, Lowell, after the American poet Robert Lowell, refers to three more places: Boston, New York, and Jerusalem. Schimmel broadens the boundaries of the place he constructs in his long poem, the place that he sees as his. He expands the place to the American side and to a most influential persona in his life. This becomes another formative step in Schimmel's development as a poet. In the third book of the long poem Ara, Midrash Tadshe, Schimmel expands his place even further, like Olson, who wanders from Gloucester to Tyre and Mesopotamia to the ancient world and ancient travelers. Schimmel wanders in this part of the poem in the basin of the Mediterranean to ancient civilization, once inhabited that place and still do. For Schimmel, too, the myth is part of the land, and the poet, who is native to the land, resurrects this myth. Schimmel's long poem, like Olson's and the American tradition after Pound, is not based on a narrative but rather on an accumulation within a specific outline that allows the separate parts to grow together and remain independent. This is the poetic model of organic growth, in which the poet is always in the present, within the poetic and physical space. The present is an opening, a starting point for renewed digging in search of the remnants that created the formal beginning and the present. Like Olson, whose words I just quoted, Schimmel is an archaeologist of mourning. This is the general frame, the general picture. And now we can read two sections, or actually four sections, from Schimmel's long poem. As I mentioned, the book Lowell revolves around the poet Robert Lowell, so here's an example. This poem describes Robert Lowell in Jerusalem. Like many poets, you hardly excelled at travel. Italy seemed to you like America, a slightly older America. As in your 20s childhood, your Amsterdam was a kind of 19th century Boston. Outwardly, all canals and pretty little Baroque brick houses. A Protestant, worldly, and English-speaking city. Holland itself, a flat country with a gray climate, often reminded you of Columbus and Mount Vernon. You stood on the steps of Montefiore's windmill, that's in Jerusalem, like a camel in snow, blinded by the glare. On the beach, a trio with your friend Elizabeth Bishop, among the wing-painted kites, a mixture of prince and schoolboy. At the same time, the book Lowell describes the broader artistic and poetic scene during the 60s in Boston, New York, and Jerusalem. It consists of 103 sonnets in three sections, according to the three cities and conforming to Dante's principle in the Divine Comedy. Boston is the Inferno. New York, Purgatory, and Jerusalem, Paradise, where the poet Schimmel chose to live. Here are two sonnets describing the atmosphere in Boston in the 60s. The second is dedicated to Olson, but the first two hints to personas from the same cultural scene. Sonnet number 4 from the book Lowell. John Shan, son of Ben. We met at Fenway, near the fine arts, and arrived at the bay windows of my studio apartment at the corner of Fairfield. Inside, on the white walls, a small de Kooning that Edwin lent and a Stuart Davis gouache from the jazz era in orange and blue. The radiator chirping and chamber music on FM and the blonde, gory voices of two stewardesses on the other side of the wall pouring Zinfandel from a huge glass carafe and sitting next to a folding card table on a pair of chairs, this banal poem stops as the Largo movement stopped that day to announce the writer Norman Mailer stabbed his wife. And here comes Olson, all the way from Gloucester to Boston to show Schimmel new ways in jazz. Sonnet 27 from the book Lowell. Big men and floor tiles, fold lengthwise, join the knees, creatures people like, to the heavy, thoughtful head, the eye socket with a constellation of hair in balance. Embrace yourself and check the possibilities. A giant body also likes self-intimacy. Love the earth. Bend the upper to the ground, and yet it suits the multidimensioned man better to stand on his feet or bend over like the Etruscan on the cover of a sarcophagus supporting himself on the elbow to stretch out at an angle. Olson in a college dormitory, listening to jazz records in a cardboard shoebox, sleepy and humble, getting out of his car that brought him from Gloucester. So that's the Inferno. And just as you could feel the atmosphere of paradise, that is Jerusalem, let's end with a sonnet from the third section of the book Lowell, describing the American poet Robert Lowell in reading in Jerusalem. Robert Lowell did visit Jerusalem. It was just after the war in 67. And Schimmel was his, welcomed him and showed him around. Like a bird of prey casting its shadow from on high, rabbits and snakes fleeing, you surveyed the cruel circle of seats, the huge, overstuffed, uncomfortable chair intended for you, and sat decisively elsewhere, next to a girl in a short skirt, whom, with a bit of experience and cunning, you knew you'd be able, after a third whiskey, to touch casually hand to her knee. Consoling yourself in your awakeness. The room was musty dark and stank of cat piss. For 5 minutes or so, you seemed anxious about your breathing, a major theme in notebook and history. When the drinks took hold and you'd stopped being picky, you pinched the poet Leah Goldberg. In the kitchen, she questioned the nerve of these goyim who drink themselves into stupor and don't see a thing. I should mention that Leah Goldberg wasn't young at the time. So he was drunk most of the time. I heard many stories about it. We move on to the second Israeli poet, Aharon Shabtai. Aharon Shabtai is a famous Israeli poet and generally considered an important one. It's fair to say that his followers, as well as his critics, see him as part of the established Israeli culture, which might be considered a paradox, as Shabtai was and still is a ferocious critic of Israeli culture and politics. This contradiction shows the power of the establishment to eventually embrace even its strongest critics, but at the same time, it's because over the years, Shabtai identified with very different social and political beliefs, always aiming his arrows at what he considered the Israeli consensus and literary conventions. Shabtai was born in Tel Aviv in 1939. He grew up on kibbutz, studied philosophy and classical studies at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and received his PhD from the Sorbonne in Paris. He was a professor of Greek theater and is a prolific translator from classic Greek to modern Hebrew. He is one of the few Israeli poets who have an English-speaking audience, largely due to his book of poems, Jacuz. This one, published by New Direction in 2003, translated by Peter Cole. Over the years, Shabtai had written poems in which he openly declared his political and social views. Regardless of the contradictions between his different views, he had always written them as absolute poetic truths. Here is a straightforward poet exposing and declaring his deep faith in specific poetic values, even if they happen to change from one extreme to the next along his poetic career. As an avid critic, Shabtai's poetry is public even when it's personal and intimate. As a young poet, the work of American poets like Williams and Olson were part of his poetic arsenal against the literary establishment. Let me start with a passage from Kibbutz, Shabtai's second book, published in 1973, translated by Peter Cole. Kibbutz, as some of you might remember, is a collective community typical to Israeli and traditionally based on agriculture. The kibbutzim in plural, began as utopian communities influenced by socialist values and adjusted to the Zionist ideology. And here is Shabtai's kibbutz. I read from the second section of the book, Our Culture. Our cultures contained in a few tools and objects, i.e. a straw broom, a chisel, a pitchfork and scoop, caustic soda for the calf's horns, a rubber pipe, a glass tube, and inseminator glove, a battery set in a wheelbarrow, covered with burlap, tied to a wire in the pasture, a system of swinging gates, barriers, and rails to guide the cattle, a hooked rod for fetching chickens, a bee clipper and carbolic acid sprayer to disinfect the woodwork, a hoe stuck at the end of a row of beets, or safflower beside the path that cuts across the fields of corn, patches of staked tomatoes passing through an olive grove to sorghum tracts and vetch, near the hay press and harrows, a seed plow in a can beneath its perforated seat, pitchers of soap and lemonade, aluminium plates, a tin of chopped meat, a vegetable garden's wheel hoe, a potato combine, a pyramid of crates, sacks, and rubber baskets. It goes on. Kibbutz is a long poem in 7 parts, describing routine life on kibbutz. It is a book about a particular place and a particular way of life typical to the community living there. Once again, we find that it is both the persistence of place and the idea of the long poem that attract Shabtai in Olson. Yet, as the lines above show, it is also the poetic technique of naming, cataloging and bringing together of tools, objects, professions and functions dominating the place, this time the agricultural life on kibbutz, instead of fishery and whaling. Indeed, if the reader is unfamiliar with this particular way of life, there's a whole new vocabulary to be learned, which is to say that the objects surrounding a man are part of a living culture and not dead furniture, and man is himself, as Olson says, such an object in the culture of objects, that is, a part of his environment, he is tied to the material world that supplies his living. Everyday activities are thus presented as clear and simple facts, and Shabtai adds his own insights, phrased as general truths, from time to time, in between the lists of tools and activities. The speaker in the poem is a member of the community. His individual identity and his particular experience are less important than the collective community and communal life. Kibbutz, he was influenced by Olson, though he had his own interpretation of Olson's work. Shabtai admits his debt to Olson and other American poets in his manifesto from the same period. That's Shabtai in Hebrew translated. When I say poetic anthropology, I repeat particular patterns, William Carlos Williams' American mythology, Charles Olson's Maximus poems that deal with space, time, work, ecology, mythology, and polis. I mention them in order to draw the attention of the reader that decadence devoured Hebrew literature to the last bite, and now the new generation knows only lessening and reduction methods, whereas constructive possibilities, building a world, a myth, a mind, have always been, from Homer to Dante, from Rabelais to Joyce, the advantage of the art of writing. We must, therefore, renew our learning and resurrect work, objects, history, myth, and establishments. The new perception of the object, therefore, requires, on the one hand, that meticulous analytical interpretation regarding, for example, objectivist poets, George Open, Zukovsky, and on the other hand, at the very same time, requires unrelenting perception of the image, that is to say, a mythological mind and an ability to create a myth. These two skills, the objective and the mythopoeic, are eventually made into one. In the poetry of Williams and Olson, the objectivist process became a mythological expansion. The objectivism spread to become mythological and didactic sequences of history, folk wisdom, and anthropology. That's Shabtai's manifesto. In Shabtai's early manifests, there is a critical and poetic thought influenced by American poets. After the long poem Kibbutz, Shabtai began writing another long poem, the domestic poem. In Kibbutz and the domestic poem, Shabtai used the inventory of his surroundings, trying to construct the space of the poem while structuring himself as part of his environment. But thereafter he changed course, and the lyrical ego he was trying to get rid of in his objectivist period resurfaces and takes the reins again. Looking back at Shabtai's early work, one can realize the impact of Whitehead's process and reality on Olson's work. While Shabtai lacks a theoretical principle that would make his objective expansion coherent, it seems to me that Whitehead was such a revelation for Olson. For in process and reality, Olson found theoretical paradigm into a deeper coherence which makes the different objects connect and grow together in time, what organizes the poem into an organic development. Starting the Maximus poems, Olson's motto was one makes many, but as he kept on, the question of how the many becomes one turned to be fundamental. Whitehead's role was crucial in showing Olson a path in this direction. while Shabtai had no metaphysical foundations and was once again defeated by the imperialistic ego. His later poetry is completely different from these early books. Let me end this part of the discussion with a few more lines from the section called Education in the book Kibbutz. On the kibbutz, one hunts for a buzzard. In the field, one finds a swamp cat. One shoots a bird from within a boat on the fish pond. Each class has a house of its own. In each such house, there are 6 rooms, and each room has 4 beds. The closet has compartments and a shelf for every child. At the end of the hall, there's a classroom. At the other end are the toilets and the showers. There's also a bathroom, just for the counselor. Above each towel, there's a label for names. Extra clothes are kept in the basement. There's another common storeroom for bikes. A shack where bedspreads are woven. The dining room's a larger shack, imported from Sweden or Germany. The students get seedlings or buffalo grass. The students get chemicals. The students get a fetus preserved in formaldehyde. The students are given a room for taxidermy. The students are given a painted sink plugged with stencils. The students are given drafting boards. The students are given a steel stylus. The students are given a scraper. The students are given acid, oxygen, headphones, radio crystal, a magnet, shovel, syringe, a hunting rifle, a trap, a sack, and glue, a jar, paint, a typewriter, and so on and so forth. We move on to the third Israeli poet, Zali Gurevich. Excuse me for 1 minute. That's what happens when you come to Gloucester from Israel. It was 40 degrees or 38. That's like 85 degrees when we left Israel. So I got cold. Zali Gurevich was born in California in 1949 and arrived in Israel with his parents as an infant. He is a professor of sociology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He began publishing poetry in 1967, and he is also a translator of American poetry. Gurevich is in fact the one we should thank regarding Charles Olson. He published 2 essays on Olson in literary magazine, Hebrew literary magazine, the only introduction to Olson's poetry ever written in Hebrew. We should therefore discuss Gurevich first as a mediator of poetry. These 2 essays, published in 1983 and 1989, included a few translations into Hebrew from the Maximus poems. The later essay, which is also the longer one, is a very beautiful and rich essay where Gurevich depicts the main points in Olson's worldview. This is how it begins, my translation. The place to begin discussing Olson is Gloucester, a small fishing community on the Atlantic north of Boston. A proper beginning indeed. As I mentioned, it was published in a poetry magazine. I stumbled on it long after I made acquaintance with the Maximus poems, and it was a very interesting experience. Olson in Hebrew, my mother tongue, but not in the language I felt or thought about Olson, who for me represented something very remote from Hebrew and from Israel. Anyway, don't be alarmed, even with this publication in that very prestigious poetry magazine for poetry lovers only, you don't have to be a math wizard to count the number of people who have heard of Olson in Israel. Among other things, Gurevich was interested in Olson because in his early poetry he was searching for ways to connect streams of thoughts in one long process confined by place, facts, and body. As a poet, he appreciated the renewing process of learning, that archaeology of mourning that Olson spoke about, a methodology in which the reductive and objective self will replace the lyrical romantic self. Two books of Gurevich's where Olson's influence is most apparent are Land, Yabasha in Hebrew, And Land from 1989 and Breath, Hevel from 1990. In Land, Gurevich contemplates the meaning of land as a particular place and conducts a dialogue with Olson. I read from section 7 from the book Land. Behind, I got rid of an entire world. I went out strong. My spirit leaped, hungry for another, to seize it. Here it was seized by those heading west from afar. A large land sits in the water, neither rush nor gold, but here from the water. They mounted a virgin land, held it in their arms. They sat, burning around it. They crowded huts against the sea winds at the place where they first started fishing and trading furs. Indians, as thin as dogs, wandered around the fires. 14 Englishmen managed to light, Olson wrote. The ship that brought them, we don't even know its name and who owned it. The allusion to another place, to the American continent, seems too simple, perhaps, for this passage, but the comparison between Gurevich and Olson in regard to place is fascinating. In the Hebrew Jewish Zionist sense, the concept place and the term place resonate very differently from English parallel. The term the place, place is makom in Hebrew, and the place hamakom. The term the place means not only a concrete piece of land, but also the name of God. Hamakom is the name of God in Hebrew. In other words, in Hebrew, a territorial connection to a place automatically assumes a collective Jewish ideological identity. As I previously mentioned, Gurevich is a professor of sociology, and indeed he has written about the question of place. I quote from one of his essays. The land, as an object of reflection for Israelis and as a means to converse with the past, with the book, is not the book with a capital B, meaning the Bible. Is not mere territory, but rather the we of a people with a common fate and perhaps even a common mission. The Israeli preoccupation with the land is thus the conversation that lies at the heart of Israeli identity. In the land, or as it will be termed, the place, with a capital P, Israelis engage in the search for the source of their collective identity. With the foundation of the State of Israel, the old conflict, or the dialectics, between the purpose of the Jewish people as the people of the land, Am Haaretz, on the one hand, and as the people of the book, Am HaSefer, on the other, gained new significance. Therefore, in Hebrew, place is not just a place, it is a place with a capital P. It's the place of the Lord who gave the land to his chosen people, etc. So when you're trying to write a poem about the place in Hebrew, it's always one place. This is but an example of the problems arising when translating one culture to another. In Hebrew, we can't do away with the main meaning of the term the place, the name of God. As previously mentioned, I came across Gurevich's essay long after making my acquaintance with the Maximus poems, and in fact, I was in the final stages of my PhD dissertation on Olson. To sum up this Israeli evening, I will share with you my own path to Charles Olson's poetry and to Gloucester. In a way, it is because of Schimmel and Lowell. I was completely unfamiliar with American poetry when I read Schimmel's book, Lowell. And while reading it, I realized I had to learn who is who in the multitudes of names that Schimmel mentions. Imagine a book in Hebrew named Lowell, and in it are so many names which are Americans and local. And, I mean, nobody understands what he's talking about. So while reading it, I had to realize, I had to learn who is who in these multitudes of names that Schimmel mentions: poets, painters, artists, streets, buildings, places, and institutions. I was born in Jerusalem, grew up in Haifa, and went back to Jerusalem to study at the Hebrew University. I have never lived in the U.S., and nothing seemed familiar to me in Schimmel's long poem. Schimmel introduced me to Lowell, Lowell introduced me to Berryman, and then to Bishop, to Crane, to Whitman, and to many others. I majored in philosophy and comparative literature. By reading on my own, I got acquainted with English and American poetry. One poet led me to another, and this is how I came across Olson by chance, if you will. I was very much interested in the tradition of the long poem, the American long poem, and had just finished my MA thesis that dealt with the long poems in the poetry of Lowell, Berryman, and Schimmel. I would spend hours at the Hebrew U library, sporadically pulling out books from the shelves of the American poetry section. One day I pulled out a real big one. It was so huge. The Maximus poems. Can there be a better name for a poem that its length is not just technical but essential? I decided to write my PhD on the Maximus poems. I learned that Shabtai was influenced by Olson and made it into a comparative dissertation. I didn't think much when I decided to write about the Maximus poems, and it turned out a fortunate mistake. I call it a mistake because I had no idea what I was in for. The Maximus poem turned out to be a world in itself, an unknown universe. I found myself a Jerusalemite, afraid of dipping my toes in the puddle of the Mediterranean, sailing the oceans in my daily chase of too big a fish. As I said, it was a fortunate mistake, fortunate because it led me here, to Gloucester. I should also mention that the first time I came here was after I had written my dissertation, and that's when I met Henry and Kenny. And I should say that Henry asked me about, he was asking me this question and said, so what do you think about Gloucester coming and so on? And I said, I'm not disappointed. And he liked it. I think that's why he wanted to film me. So I came here after I had written my dissertation. In other words, I had Gloucester of the mind before ever strolled on Main Street. And in this sense, I feel that the Maximus was an invitation to come to Gloucester. One of the things I like most about the Maximus poem is its openness to almost everything, any kind of material. The poet offers you an acquaintance with the world that he himself is learning. He reads and writes, learns and teaches, and in this sense, he invites you to go on beyond him. I think that the Gloucester Writer's Center is doing just that. My book about Olson and Whitehead was written almost 15 years ago. I have since written other books on other poets and other subjects, including my own poetry and fiction. However, I keep returning to Gloucester because of the place and the people, many of whom have become friends. I thank you for coming here tonight.
Sure, people have any questions of Shahar, though I'm happy to answer them. Try to.
Jennifer.
What you say about the land and the whole resonance of that notion, I think from a poet's standpoint, not so much from a political standpoint, from a poet's standpoint, what it means to speak of a land where there are so many layers of civilizations in conflict, and you speak of. In other words, how does a poet deal with that issue of whose land is it and how is it someone's land and when is it someone's land and all that sort of thing? And also, how is it a spiritual land as opposed to a political land?
Are you referring to any poet in particular?
No. Oh. Well, I'm from them, but since they've written about one called land, but...
I think Schimmel is a very good... it's an interesting case because Schimmel grew up in the U.S. and he immigrated to Israel. And coming to Israel, I think he came as a Zionist, you know, and he came to his chosen land. And in the beginning, he preferred to repress all this American biography and all his childhood and everything. And he started writing only about Israel and about this, the first part of his long poem, Ara. All these local, you know, cities and places in Israel, imagining himself as part of it and making himself at the same time as part of the Israeli milieu, Israeli land and whatever. But then he acknowledged that you can't start from, you know, from the middle and you have to go back. So the next book was Lowell, where he go. And the third one was going even, he acknowledged that Israel itself, as you say, is there's so many layers, the Mediterranean, so he began exploring what's deeper under, so to speak, under his seat, you know, what he's sitting on a space which is layered with so many different civilizations and stuff. So this is an example, I think, in this regard, that you can't ignore, as a poet, even not as a poet, you can't ignore those many layers.
And the notion that the land is contested to this day. So it's not the same as the land in Gloucester, where long ago the native people were whereas there...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the political side, yeah. I mean, if you say our land, you're in it. That's it. I mean, is it ours? That's it. But and I think, once again, Schimmel is a very interesting case, because he started as, this is our land, this is my land. And then he acknowledged, no. This is not the right attitude. It's much broader, you know. Yeah, there's other people here, and so his long poem got longer and bigger, and included more and more layers in it. So he began as a Jewish Zionist sort of, and I don't know where he ends up, you know. Yeah.
What is the present contemporary poetry like, given the way Israel has gone more militaristic? Is there an opposition?
Shabtai is the opposition. J'accuse, Shabtai's book, is if that's a was published by New Directions, Peter Cole's translation, and if you get the book, it's very political. It's all against the occupation. It's where Shabtai declares, "I'm a Palestinian. This land is Palestine, and I'm a Palestinian." Exactly those words, you know. He says, "I'm a Palestinian. This is Palestine. I was born in Palestine, and that's why I'm a Palestinian, and nobody can take it from me." So it's very political. And Shabtai was always, as I said, was trying to be the opposition. But Shabtai is not. Shabtai wrote a long poem about Menachem Begin, the prime minister. So Shabtai started as a kibbutznik, as someone from the kibbutz, which is the left. And then he changed and wrote about Menachem Begin. He became right-winged, sort of right-wing. And then once again he became much more radical to the left. Very interesting. So if you look at Shabtai's career as a poet, you get everything. That's quite amazing. Yeah. You can follow it's amazing. You can follow all the changes in Israel politics, and how Shabtai adapts himself or takes, you know, a few steps back from the center. Very interesting. I don't know if I can make a generalization about Israeli poetry. I guess Israel poetry is like Israeli politics. That's it. I mean, some to the right and some to the left, and the majority is not to the left. There are some people who are, I can mention some poets, but I don't know. I don't think besides Shabtai, and I think Shabtai is the only, and some Dalia Rabikovich. I don't know if anyone heard of Dalia Rabikovich. I'm trying to think of those poets who were translated into English. Mm-hmm. So
Amichai.
Okay. Amichai is the most celebrated Hebrew Israeli poet. But Amichai is an international poet. Right. That's it. And Amichai is not that political, at least not in his later poetry. In the beginning,
on the screen, the New Directions of Jacques Cousse, was it? Did Peter Cole translate it as Love and Other, or was it IQs?
There were two books.
Two books.
Yeah, IQs, and the other. Yeah, and the other one is a selected by. Yeah.
Is Jacques Cousse written in English? Did you say?
No, it was written in Hebrew, translated.
Why the French title?
Because it comes from Zola.
Yeah,
it's ironic because Zola was defending the Jewish character.
Right.
Was
it's on purpose. Yeah, it's on purpose. He took it on purpose to say, meaning, his finger was on the Israeli establishment.
And Zola had to leave France and move to England because was going to be in trouble.
Yeah, so it's a political act. Yeah.
I think of the UK as an intensely reading population, America less so. Do people read in Israel? I mean, how intense is this?
Israel is a very small country, and people read a lot. I think statistically it's international, it's mostly women. Read more than a man, but Israelis read a lot of translations from all languages. A lot of translations. It's a very small country. We get a lot of translations. We have excellent translators to I think any language. So you get Israelis read a lot of books from all over the world, but. As I think is the case in most places, poetry is not, fiction. That's realism, realistic fiction. That's the basic.
But it's deep in the culture. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. I think the amount of books published in Israel, it's about 6,000 books in a year. That's a lot. Such a small country.
Population.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I think in Canada they publish the same amount. We once heard it was quite
per capita, like
yeah.
Per,
oh, no.
A year, 6,000 a year for our country.
It's quite amazing. I mean, and again, you. It is. It is. And same problems. Books being published, but it. If it's not a bestseller, you can't find it, and so on. It's the same story.
But books that are English language are they typically translated into Hebrew, or do people read them in English?
No, everything's translated.
Into Hebrew? So even though, don't most people have a working grasp of English?
Yeah, but not reading.
Not for reading.
No. It's different. Most people read in Hebrew. They're used to Hebrew, and I would even say that English is the most
translated
books from English. I think so, and probably the U.S., not the U.K.
And I got the impression that Maximus hasn't been fully translated.
Just a few fragments. Yeah,
so
fragments
that you talked about all. Obviously read it in the original.
Shabtai was I should mention one. Shimmer grew up here, so Shimmer reads English. Zali Goevich speaks fluent English, reads in English, translates from English, excuse me. And Shabtai read also in English too, and if I remember well, Shabtai was here during like the 70s or so. I don't exactly remember when, but I remember when we met Shimmel, he brought us one of those cassettes, audio cassettes. It was a long time ago, which Shabtai recorded in Boston, or of Olson reading his poetry or something. Mm-hmm. So Shabtai heard Olson in Boston or somewhere. But Shabtai, Shimmel is, I think Shimmel heard about Olson from, excuse me, I think Shabtai heard of Olson from Shimmel. I think Shimmel is like the center. Shimmel brought to Jerusalem like an American heritage, you know, he brought with him so much stuff, his knowledge of poetry, and he knew those like Robert Lowell and other. He knew them personally.
And he's the oldest of these guys. He's a generation.
He was born 1935, and Shabtai is 39, I think. Oh. So it's basically the same.
But
yeah.
His influence is just on these poets, not on
the
wider
society
because he's unknown.
And what an Israeli poet who believes that place is sacred, is hamakom, is another way of saying God. And Israel began with an ideal, as much as the actual land, an ideal of what the land was for and what it could be. I'm trying to find just terms. I don't know how to, you can see why I can't ask the question, because
yes.
I don't know how to phrase the search for the task of what a poet of America might be as with an Israeli.
Also, was interested in the idea of, you know, like to you know, the idea of America and the ideal of the republic at you know, Watch House Point, and there was that conception of projecting the ideal onto the place too. So I think there, I mean, it's different, obviously, but, and I guess maybe you'd be the person to talk about what are those similarities and differences in the idea of a place and the actual place, maybe is.
One difference is in Israel you can't. It's always Israel. It's the state always. You know, you can't think of a particular place in Israel as against the whole state or as against the whole land. You can't divide it. Jerusalem is Israel.
Okay.
It's a microcosmos of Israel, and so you can't think of, you know, Gloucester as, you know, representing, but at the same time not.
Yes.
Doesn't work that this way because it's always like Jerusalem is Israel. You know, Tel Aviv is Israel. That's it. It's so small. It's like, you know, there's not so much space.
Because I thought I was getting it before with, you said there was Eretz, that's land, and there was the Aramaic, and then there was another one, and then there was a fourth one.
No.
Place,
the word place in Hebrew is makom. And that means, space and place in English would be merchav, place, and makom, place. I'm sorry.
Merchav,
space. Merchav is the Hebrew word for space. And makom is the Hebrew word for place.
Eretz is land.
Now, Eretz is land, but another word for land is Ara. Mm-hmm. Ara, which is, if you look at the Hebrew characters, it looks almost the same, because I don't know if you know the Hebrew alphabet, but it's Aleph, Reish, and then instead of the Tzadi, there's Ein. So it's almost the same. It comes from the same, you know. So, but that's Aramaic, Ara. And the other one is what we use today, Eretz, is a traditional, it's a Hebrew word. It's not Aramaic. But when Schimmel used as a title for his book the name Ara, it's obvious that he wants to resonate, that the word would resonate to some idioms and some archaic meanings, like there's all kind of idioms in that comes from Aramaic, Sadna de Ara, which is like the base of the land, or so it takes you further back than Eretz. Further back, it's the land that before the land.
Hamakom is also, you say, one of the names for God.
Hamakom, the place, is mm-hmm. just the name of God, like we would say in a prayer, Al Dat Hamakom, on behalf of His name of God, like speaking on behalf of God, Al Dat Hamakom. So Hamakom. If you say Hamakom, you can't get rid of, you know, so it's always, that's once again, it's like your previous question, you know, you can't differentiate the land itself from its religious aspects.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking also that in America, originally, there was an idea here, too, that the Puritans brought. I mean, the sense of the city on the hill, the New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
This place is full of ideal projections. Of what the ideal should be. So in some way, and an invention. It was an invented country in everybody's minds.
But no past.
Except what came across.
Yeah. Olson tries to create the past.
Yes.
I just want to add one thing, which I forgot to say in my talk, that the Kingfishers, Olson's poem, was translated into Hebrew, and I didn't know it was translated. I was in writing my PhD, and my supervisor, who is a very important professor of Hebrew literature. And I suddenly, you know, by accident, I open this literary magazine and I see a translation of the Kingfishers by my own supervisor, which was funny. Yeah. I didn't know that he was so.
How did he do?
He did very well. Yeah, very well. So, that's funny. But these are like the only, the Kingfishers and then some fragments from the Maximus. That's it. When I was writing my PhD, and I was already teaching in the Hebrew Department of Comparative Literature in Jerusalem, and the head of the department was talking about something, and this is just to show you Olson's place in here. And he was relating to each one's responsibilities in the department. And he said, everything will be all right, and each one can do his own stuff, like Shachar could do his esoteric stuff. You know. Nobody knew who's Olson. You know, it's like, I don't know what he's doing there. You know, let him keep on that.
It's often considered esoteric stuff here, too.
Yeah.
In the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. So, it's funny. Okay, so thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.